Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
I'm Faisal Carmelli, my co-host here, Dave Popowich. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Faisal. How are you?
We have got a great show. I'm doing great. And I'm very interested in today's show because there's different parts when it comes to what's happening out there. Mm-hmm. First, we're going to be definitely chatting about the biggest trend amongst people over the age of 50 right now.
Is it pickleball?
The second biggest trend happening to people over the age of 50, gray divorce.
Yeah.
That's a big one,
yeah.
Right? Then we also have, with this whole concept of artificial intelligence, yeah. What's all the fraud that's happening out there?
It can become be used for good and for evil, can't it?
Oh, it was like the internet was, right?
Yeah.
Good and evil.
And the bad guys figure it out quickly.
Very quickly. And yeah. So we want to make sure you're aware of some of the issues and where to get some resources to help you with what's really changing when it comes to it.
Well, we're going to bring the Alberta Securities Commission on to help understand that.
Correct. And then there's a problem that people have when they're talking about giving an inheritance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a gift isn't a gift.
Right.
Huh.
I had a really, really, I think, amazing experience this week that I want to share to help families that are in that phase of life and have the ability to gift to kids, grandkids, and so on and so forth. Because it's a two-way street to avoid the problems of the gift becoming something other than that. An argument or a problem.
Whew. You know what else was a gift this week?
What?
The markets were kind of giving us a gift of not as high a volatility as you would expect, given the economic numbers that have come out from inflation, especially in the United States.
Well, it was, well said, because it was an interesting trading week, given the fact that Tuesday and Thursday gave us inflation data points in the United States that indicated that inflation is running a little bit hotter than what was expected. And the reaction mechanism, of course, for the past 18 months has been if inflation expectations are higher or if it's higher, the expectation of the bond market yields go up and that takes equity markets down. And it was pretty much a sideways trade this past week. So it was kind of a bit of a look through on that. And I think that gives us some insights as to maybe, you know, where the market's at, rightly or wrongly, where they're at. But I think the market is still comfortable in its view that there's some sticky inflation here.
Yep.
The Fed's move, we're at peak inflation. The Fed, Bank of Canada, Bank of England, unlikely to raise rates at this particular point. But there's still a pretty active debate about when they will cut rates. And my question is to you is, who cares? Should we care about when they cut the rate?
Yeah, and I think so. Let's answer the question: who really cares about this? Bond traders.
Yeah,
I think those are the ones that probably care the most.
Yeah.
But if it's a matter of a rate cut of 0.25%, 0.5%, or 1%, what's the big difference overall to the average Canadian or average American?
Right.
Not much. Not much.
In terms of day-to-day living or in terms of investing?
What a rate cut signifies, especially to the business community, that they can now possibly take on the understand that there's going to be there's a top in their interest rate part. It's not going to go up more. So now I can now forecast what my cost would be if I want to expand,
right.
If I want to borrow money, if I want to hire people. I know what my cost of capital is.
Right.
If rates continually go up, you have no idea, especially with these loans that are out there called floating rate loans, you have no idea if you're going to be paying more and more and
what's
more.
What's your cost of capital?
So you slow down your business.
Yep.
You don't invest in it. You don't take out the loans until you know. A rate cut would signal to the business community that it's probably not going to go back up.
Right.
And that gives a bit of confidence. Will it be the moving needle and shifting of everything in the economy? I don't think so.
Right. Fair points. The other thing that came out, again, U.S. data. We get much better U.S. data than we get anywhere else, so that's why we're often talking about it. But, you know, looking at U.S. retail sales. Now, the most recent data said there was a rebound in U.S. retail spending, but it came in below expectation. So this week we had a combination of a little bit higher than expected inflation data, and a little bit lower than expected retail spending. And keep in mind that in North America, 70% of our economy is people like you and me and our listeners and viewers all going out and spending, right? Buying stuff.
Correct.
So given all of that, it was interesting to see. It was a kind of a subdued, tepid sort of trade throughout the course of the week.
And it's a lagging indicator. It's already happened. Mm-hmm. So what is happening right now? Look at the number of people that have delinquencies on their mortgages, have delinquencies on their car payments. Look at the amount of insolvencies or proposals coming out. This is more real time of where the puck is going versus where the puck was, using a hockey analogy. Yep. And I think that's where people have to understand that when they report retail sales, it already happened. When they report employment, it already happened.
It's past, yeah.
When they talk about inflation, they're talking about inflation that just happened. What's happening now that can be more of a leading indicator or consistently within the current time is also something you need to look at. And it doesn't look great. Like, it's not like there's a whole bunch of more credit being passed around, so people are growing. There's not like a whole bunch of mortgages and people are buying homes. That's a slowdown in the economy. Now, is it recessionary? To be determined.
Yep.
But it's a slowdown.
Yep.
And I think that's exactly what the central banks want. One thing that I keep on hearing is we're going to get into a major stock market crash. We're going to get into a major recession. The data doesn't show that yet.
Right.
However, there could be a slowdown.
Right.
So be prepared for all those different scenarios.
Yeah, that's right. You've got to be data dependent and adjust your strategy. Adjust your strategy. I've got to be careful how I say that. Make sure that you're disciplined in your asset allocation and make sure that you've got a compass pointing to the long-term strategy, that the outcome that you're trying to achieve.
You know, right? What I find very interesting when we're starting to see like interest rates go back up in the US this week, we saw it bounce back up from the lows and so forth. No one talks about buying bonds. No one talks about how the fixed income market is even more attractive when rates go up.
I think we've talked about that.
No. I mean, when you turn on any business news channel.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And what's interesting and sexy and entertaining is what's happening in the business world. And, oh my God, interest rates are up. This is terrible for companies. We're going to go into a massive recession. You hardly hear these business news outlets come out and say, you know, for every time that something happens in the economy or every time that something happens in the global markets, there's an opportunity to make money. Here's the opportunity.
Right.
They're talking about small cap versus large cap stocks, Canada versus international stocks. Boring bonds are getting attractive.
Or alternatives, right? There's lots of other spaces to go. And you're right. The bond markets, as a saver, central banks have essentially suppressed your ability to get return on conservative savings for the past 15 or 16 years. We can now get.
Financial repression is unwinding.
One of the unfortunate aspects, fortunate, unfortunate, I'm not sure how to say that, changes that can sometimes take place as people get older, is a change in relationship status, right? For all kinds of reasons. And this idea of gray divorce, you know, getting divorced older, later in life, is a swelling or a growing population of people being impacted by this.
The growth rate of the people who are getting divorced is probably the highest in the gray divorce area than in any other demographic in this country. Now, here is the big problem. As a divorce financial analyst, I have done hundreds of cases for different demographic or age categories. The younger you are, with or without kids, the more time you have to financially recover from your circumstance.
Right.
Not the case always when it comes to gray divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's have the conversation of why and what's going on in this area, because it's a growing trend. And we've got not only the anecdotal evidence that we see, but the empirical data as well. And that's why we have Marcus Sixta, founder, senior family lawyer, mediator at Crossroads Law, and coach my case. Marcus, welcome back on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, let's go right into it. Gray divorce, we just gave you a little bit of an intro on this, that it's growing and you're in the field. Your team, the groups in Vancouver, Calgary, and are really getting in there and they're seeing more of this. Is that correct?
Yeah, we are seeing more gray divorces coming through our office. We know now that across Canada, this is a segment that is seeing more divorces than other segments of the population. In fact, there's some research in the United States that suggests that gray divorces, while the rest of the population in terms of divorces have actually declined, gray divorces or divorces for people that are over 50 years old have actually doubled in the last 20 years. So this is a growing segment, and there may be a lot of reasons for that. One of the things that comes up quite often when we're talking to people who come in who are in their 50s or 60s or even 70s seeking a divorce is that they just don't feel like the stigma is there anymore. Like there was a stigma against divorce when they were growing up, and there was definitely a stigma against being divorced or getting a divorce while the children were in the house. But now that the children are grown and out of the house and society has changed in a lot of ways, they feel like, okay, this is the time to do it. I don't want to spend the rest of my life miserable, so I'm going to get divorced.
Marcus, when we hear the words gray divorce, a lot of times these are longer term marriages, longer term relationships. A lot of times there is a disconnect of inequality of income between both parties, generally speaking. And so there is a big shift in what happens here. Who has the biggest impact on them, financially speaking, first, when it comes to gray divorce, and why is it that way?
Well, who has the biggest impact financially is an interesting question. I would suggest that usually it's the children initially who have a large financial impact. And it may be something that people don't contemplate when they're thinking about a gray divorce. And gray divorce, from the definitions that exist, it's usually divorces over the age of 50. Children can be a big motivation for the divorce. And when I say that is, people stay together as long as the kids are in the house. And once they get out of the house, the couple may say, okay, well, now it's time we can get a divorce. The kids were taken care of and now they're off on their own. They've left the nest, we're empty nesters. Let's just go our separate ways. But quite often what they're not considering at that point is any child support obligations that actually continue past the children being 18 or 19 and continue as long as the kids are in post-secondary education, because we have laws now in Alberta and across the Canada that say that kids who are over the age of 18 but continuing in full-time studies, they require child support as well. And that can be quite expensive if you have to pay for university tuition and residency costs for universities overseas or in different areas.
So Marcus, is it the responsibility to pay the former spouse the support, or to pay for the child's education and tuition costs if they're not living with one of the parents?
Yeah, so that's a good question. If a child is living with one of the parents while they're attending university, then the support definitely would flow to that parent, the child support. I'm not even getting into spousal yet, because that's a whole other huge factor. But the child support would flow to the parent where the child is living. If the child is living in residence, then sometimes that continues, but there is an option that the support could flow to the child directly. With respect to the university expenses, those would just be paid directly to the university or the institution. And hopefully in these cases, you have an RESP, because that would be the first hit against those university expenses. And hopefully you've got a kid who's got some bursaries and scholarships.
You are saying that spousal support is another big topic. When we see gray divorce, at least even in our investment practice, and we look at these agreements that come out of it, some of these divorce agreements state that support for spousal support is indefinite. And that kind of gives the four-letter words come up after I mentioned that when we have a conversation with a lot of our clients or people who want to know about this. So what does that really mean, and what's the real impact for spousal support when you're going through a gray divorce?
Well, spousal support and property division are going to be the biggest hits for sure when you're talking about a gray divorce. Spousal support for long-term relationships, you're looking at sharing 50-50 with respect to the net disposable incomes of the parties. So you basically pool the net disposable income together and then share that 50-50 with your spouse. So if you're in a situation where one person has always been the primary income earner, the other person perhaps has stayed home with the kids, that's a huge shift in incomes after you separate. And I should be clear as well that that spousal support obligation starts upon separation. We know that sometimes it can take a while to get through the divorce process. The courts are very slow. We, you know, have a well-recorded and much publicized shortage of judges across this country. And so you can't even get into trial these days for a year or sometimes a couple of years if it's a lengthy and complicated matter. So the spousal support obligation can be a giant adjustment when you're talking about planning your ongoing expenses. Because you're going to be splitting everything. Two houses, you're going to double your costs.
Marcus, let me just jump on that particular point. In your experience, and I'm not suggesting anybody stays together for financial reasons. There's obviously bigger issues going on. But what is the expectation? You know, in this world, if somebody's coming to you, they want to get a divorce, the average Canadian, what should their expectation be in retirement from a financial perspective? What impact is it going to have?
Well, it's going to have a massive impact. I mean, you were sharing expenses previously, sharing the food costs, sharing the vacation costs, sharing the costs for your home heating bill and perhaps your vehicle. Now, if you have two households, you're doubling the costs of everything. So it is a massive financial hit. And typically we see that it's more of a financial hit for the women in the situation, especially with long-term and traditional marriages and gray divorces, because of there's more of that in that demographic. So there's just a massive financial hit. And what the courts do as a result, if it's a long-term relationship, is they want it, like I said, they want to equalize that net disposable income, and they're going to equalize all the assets. So really what we like to see when people come in is we like to see people who have perhaps a prenuptial agreement or a cohabitation agreement that can organize how these things are split up, so that you're not spending a whole bunch of extra legal fees to get this done. And we also like to see people who come in who are looking for mediation services or collaborative divorce services. So again, they can bypass a lot of the lengthy processes and expensive legal fees and come up with a solution that's a little bit more creative than what a judge is going to give you. Because a judge, all they're going to do is interpret the legislation and the case law, and then they give you a decision. There's not a lot of extra room for creativity.
There's a lot of ways to handle a divorce. It's not just going in front of a judge. There's so many ways to solve this problem. If you're going through this, I suggest that you get legal advice for sure, even if you're doing it on your own, because Crossroads Law and Coach My Case can help you in both sides of that manner. If you want to get connected with them, Marcus, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, they can just reach us at our website. It's crossroadslaw.ca, coachmycase.com. Coach My Case is an alternative legal service that helps people who are self-representing in the legal system because they don't qualify for legal aid and they can't afford a lawyer to go to court and run a trial for them. We know that most people in Canada, they don't have, you know, $50,000 sitting around to spend on legal fees or more to go to a trial. And so a lot of people end up going in on their own. So what we do with Coach My Case is we provide coaching services in the background to help them get through the process.
It's an unfortunate reality in our business, Faisal, that there are things like fraudsters and fraud where people get, you know, damaged financially in terms of the scams that get caught up on. And so we've every single year made it a point of connecting with the Alberta Securities Commission to bring, certainly during Fraud Prevention Month, to let everybody know what's going on and be careful out there.
You know, when you look at the new technology that's out, and of course, artificial intelligence or AI has been the theme that people have been talking about outside of the securities world, just talking about businesses in general, and the fear of what AI can do, I think this is a good time to actually bring that to life on what's really happening out there and what people can do. And that's why we have Hillary McMeekin. She's the Director, Communications and Investor Education at the Alberta Securities Commission. Hillary, welcome back on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. This is such an important conversation.
So seen over the last 20 years how fraud has been a big part of Fraud Prevention Month, which the Alberta Securities Commission has put on. Over the 20 years, let's talk about how it's changed, how fraud has changed when you look back over the last 20 years.
You hit the nail on the head. Technology, right? technology plays a significant role. We're in a digital world today, and that is very different. But I first want to start, the other thing that we've noticed is that people who would call themselves investors have changed. Once upon a time, those were the people that were consciously, they were considering stocks. They maybe were talking to advisors, right? They were consciously thinking about investing. Today, we're seeing more people who I think are unfortunately harmed by the cost of inflation, the cost of living, and they're finding any way possible to make more money. And so because of that space, and because they're so active on the digital world, which is where technology comes in, they can really become quite vulnerable, unfortunately, because they hear something, right? And fraudsters once upon a time would call us on the phone, they'd come to our door, right? Now they find us on WhatsApp, they find us on texts, they find us on our when we're searching on Google, social media platforms, dating apps. That's where they're going because that's where we are. We spend so much time on websites and on our smartphones. They figured out ways to get a hold of us there. And they prey upon us using some pretty old and tried and true techniques. But unfortunately, because of technology, it just smooths the process out for them, right? Because, you know, they're able to convince people that they should get access, like, you know, I can help you invest if you just give me access to your computer. And so they give access, right? Somebody, there's a prompt and you click, yes, sure, come on. But in that process, the fraudsters are now having access to your personal information, your banking information. And they get access to things they never had before because of how integrated we are into technology.
Hillary, would you say that's what stayed the same? Where the people are is where the fraudsters will go. I remember when I was younger, there was a lot of quote-unquote fraud cases happening at large congregation areas such as malls and theaters and places like that where people would all get together and something could happen there with regards to fraud. Now people are, although en masse, even though you're in your own home, online, mm-hmm. on the internet. So would you say that's been consistent? The fraudsters go where the people are?
They go where the people are, and they also leverage those social connections, right? Like we've called it friend fraud, affinity fraud. Like, I mean, you might have heard both those terms. They know that if they hook a couple of people, those couple of people will be so excited that they'll share it with their friends and family. And now they've got double the number of people. So they rely on those social circles. They just might access us differently. And they also, Faisal, they have never stopped that really high pressure sales tactic, right? Get in now, don't miss this chance. Like, and it's intense. I've been caught up in it before, and you feel like you forget that you actually have control, that you actually can say, no, I don't want to continue this conversation, or no, I'm not going to share my personal information. It's really hard.
Hillary, just for conversation purposes and so people can understand, now, the Popwitch Carmelli Advisory Group has multiple social media platforms. We're on social media. Personally, I have social media as well, and I'm engaging with the audience as well there. I can tell you I've officially counted in the month of February, preparing for this interview, in the month of February alone, 375 different messages sent to me on, you are at risk on losing your profile. Click here if you want to get something free. There's some cryptocurrency you can purchase for half the discount. Gold available to be transferred right to your door. Like all these different ways of trying to phishing. Hopefully I'll click on something is what their intent is. Mm-hmm. But it was unbelievable the amount that I get alone. Now, if you don't get that much frequency, you're not going to be aware of it all the time. You might think, hey, something special came to me. And this has happened to a lot of people that we know. Yep. Some of our viewers, yep, have been victims of this type of fraud. They've clicked something. It looks like the bank. They put in their banking information.
Yep.
And before you know it.
Right. And these are not gullible people, right? You can't, I think, stereotype that this is somebody who is gullible. It's not. It's regular, everyday, well-educated people. that are falling victim to these things.
And that's the thing. That's what makes these fraudsters so, they are professionals at what they do, because all of us are our prey. All of us.
Now we're coming to the topic, Hillary, of artificial intelligence. And this is a lot of fear as the technology in relative to everything else out there is fairly new. And so here's the fear that we have as advisors of clients. The fear is someone calls us and it sounds like our client. There's conversations that we've had in the past with the clients that can pick up some of the same criteria that we've had. For example, I know Mr. Smith went fishing last week and he said, oh, my fishing trip was great. Faisal, can you transfer $20,000 out of my account? Those are the fears that we have. Now, we have a whole bunch of checks and balances that we put through our clients before we transfer any money out. So I'm comfortable with our processes, but I don't think everybody is comfortable with the fact that AI can literally change the way fraud is being conducted. From your perspective, what should people do knowing that AI is here and probably going to be here to stay?
Oh, such a great point. And some of this is just knowing that it exists, right? Some of this is just being aware that this happens. So we see fraudulent websites all the time. People spin up, like a fake website that says it's you, Faisal. And the only way, part of it is us doing our due diligence. The best advice I can say is slow down. Slow down and do your own research. Because things like AI, and as an example, AI affects images, right? They're doctoring images to make you think that a business is legitimate, that a business is actually operating where they're operating, right? Or they might use a video. I was shocked. I went onto Google one day, and there was an ad, and it was using AI, and it was copying our prime minister, but it had managed to take, and the only reason I knew that was because I could tell that's a space where he's done news conferences in the past. So it had been cut and pasted from a video news conference, and they were using it as a way to hook you in to say the prime minister believes in this investment opportunity. This is your chance too. So some of it is being skeptical. Some of it is pausing and saying, wait a minute, have I seen that image before? And in some cases, we can use Google for good and do research on the entity that you might be getting sold, the individual. We can use Google for good by just doing some checks and balances before we jump in.
I think that's some great advice right there. Yep. Slow down, do your research, get a second opinion before you act. I think that's an important piece from a trusted source. Yep. And of course, how do they get more information about all these different topics that you're covering when it comes to Fraud Prevention Month?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. So a couple of things. We rolled out actually this year a new resource called 31 Days of Red Flags and Scams. Really, that's it in a nutshell. And it's a live interactive page, but it's also a handout. You can download the handout. And it's 31 of sort of the top things that, bottom line, these are the things that never change, no matter how much technology fraudsters use, or these are the fundamental things that you should always prepare yourself or know about, just be aware about. And we made it accessible at checkfirst.ca. And checkfirst.ca, honestly, is a really valuable resource for anybody because it isn't biased, right? In so many places where you go, banks are selling products to you. Right? There's information and there's bias inherent. Our information is intentionally unbiased. We want people to have the same access to the same information that we have. And so that's what we make available.
We could talk about this for a lot longer than we have the allocated time for. Hillary, I want to thank you so much for providing us some great information and a resource and the work that you all do at the Securities Commission. We've been joined by Hillary McMeekin, Director of Communications and Investor Education at the Alberta Securities Commission.
There's lots of people in this city, across the country, really across the world, Faisal, that will have more assets that they've accumulated in their lifetime than they will use up by the time that they're gone. And they're going to be faced with a transition of those assets. And that transition can take during your lifetime, take place during your lifetime. It can take place, you know, once you're gone, whatever your specific wishes are. But we unfortunately see scenarios where that gift that's being given to the next generation, charity, other people, whatever it might be, is often not received in a way that they wanted. It sometimes create problems in families. And I think there needs to be some thought.
If you're listening right now or you're watching this on our show, I'd like you to grab a pen and paper and write down what you think the value of your assets are right now. Your home, all your savings, your car, your jewelry, everything. Mm-hmm. Write that number down, whatever that number is. Now imagine you're going to give this total amount to one charity. Would you just give it? Or would you do a little bit of research about the charity?
On which charity?
On which charity? What are they going to do with the money? Mm-hmm. How fiscally responsible they may be?
Yep.
When we see large donations going to charitable organizations, there's a level of due diligence that's being done by the donor. But when you give a gift to the next generation or the generations after that, is the same due diligence happening?
No, it's not. And you know, it's a two-way street. This notion of gifting. I had an experience this past week. This was a gift in the lifetime. Okay, while the person was alive. And we'd had a number of conversations about this. There's a couple of things we talk to people about if they're thinking of gifting. That number one, it's a one-way transaction, okay? And are there any strings attached to this money? Now, often people will say no to that, but they do have an idea of what they want the kids to spend it on. And if they spend it, kids spend it differently, then it can lead to problems. So having this conversation, we set up a family gifting meeting. And this was really, really impactful. For me, included being the facilitator of this conversation, because the person that was gifting, it was going to be to four people, and it's a substantial amount. And I started the meeting by not talking about the dollar value of it, but that it was substantial enough that this person could have any number of experiences that they wanted.
Yeah.
So they have this money, they could take it and spend it on a fancy car.
Yeah, I love when you do this.
Right.
So to give context to everybody else, when Dave sits down with this family or any family that he's sat down with, and he knows the number in the back of his head that the client wants to gift to their children or grandchildren. Yeah. And so he knows what you can do with that money.
Right.
So you can buy a very expensive vehicle, or you can,
take fly an amazing around the world, trip, right?
Or, yeah. These are big numbers that are being sent out to these next generation of children and grandchildren. And so you position it as, just remember, mom and dad
can do this.
Can do whatever the hell they want with this.
That's right.
Let me give you some examples.
Yep.
Why do you do that?
Well, because it brings it into it. So here's my thing about gifting, I guess. So I raised that so that they understood that this money could be used for other things. And so the gift in this particular case was the experience that this person was choosing to have. So I first of all wanted to give context to that, so kids and grandkids understood that. And then what we did is, excuse me, we went around the room and we talked a little bit about what the amount of money, because they each knew what they were going to be getting. What was it going to mean to them? What were they going to do with it? Amazing conversation. And at the end of it, I said, listen, here's the homework. If you accept that the act of gifting is the experience that, dad, grandpa wants to have, then here's what I would ask you to do. Out of respect, write down, actually take the time, be purposeful and thoughtful of how you're going to spend this money. Write it down. Why are you going to spend it the way you are? And what impact is it going to have for you and or your family going forward? And then engage him in that conversation.
This is when you keep on saying to people, this is when a gift is not a gift.
Right.
When you give a gift, there are literally no strings attached. Do whatever you want. And let me give you an example so people can kind of get their head around this one. When I give my daughter, when she was 2 years old, a gift, and she opens up the box, takes the toy out, throws the toy out on the side, and plays with the box, mm-hmm. I can't be mad at that.
Right.
It's a gift for her. She can do whatever she wants with it. She can break the toy the very next day.
Right. And so And so that there's a responsibility on both parties, isn't there? There's, generally speaking, when we're gifting money, it's not really without some idea of what you'd like to see them do with it.
Correct.
I can give you example after example of people helping a child out of debt. And then 1 year into the future, they're in exactly the same amount of debt.
Correct.
Okay. That never ends well, right? It doesn't sit well with people. Or parents foregoing some experience they want to have, okay, to give money to pay down a mortgage. And then all of a sudden it gets spent on a fancy car. Well, hang on a second.
Yeah.
I could have had that fancy car.
So remember, a transfer of wealth is also a transfer of values. Mm. When people generally pass on their wealth, especially while they're alive, their values also go with that transfer.
Right. Good point. Great point.
And if you do what you do with that money doesn't match my value system, it's going to be a problem.
Right.
What I like what you do with families that of ours, that you, of our clients that you deal with, and you sit down and you say, let's do a test. You know you're going to give them a whole bunch of money when you pass.
Right.
We've put it in writing for you that of what the estimated amount is.
Yep.
Why don't you test them out? Take a little nibble out of that wealth and pass it on to them while they're alive and see how they react. The smaller the nibble, the less of an eye opener it will be to see that the value get transferred with the wealth.
Right.
But when they test it and they see how the reaction is, they see what they do with the money, the parent or grandparent gets to see how that person lived with that money. That's an impact.
It is an impact. And it was incredibly impactful for all of us. I love doing those conversations because it's meaningful. It's about education as well. Good stewards of wealth, passing that along. Okay, let's talk about all of these topics and more at our upcoming seminars.
Two seminars, one in Lethbridge on Tuesday, March 19th, and in Calgary on April the 16th. Join us on morethanmoneyradio.com to register. That's morethanmoneyradio.com to register.
On behalf of myself, Dave, and Faisal and the rest of the team that helps us put the show together, thanks for tuning in to another edition of More Than Money on QR Calgary. We look forward to speaking with you again next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.